Catherwood and Quay, memorable characters in new fiction from writers Jill McCorkle and Marley Yeomans, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to the Center's weekly radio magazine about books and ideas. Jill McCorkle and Marley Yeomans are here with readings and conversation about their new books. Jill McCorkle's latest novel is Carolina Moon. Marley Yeomans' new book is Catherwood. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. First on the program this week, Jill McCorkle. She's here now with an excerpt from her new novel, Carolina Moon.
When Lonnie died, she pulled out all the photos she had secretly stashed over the years, and she spent hours cutting and piecing them into frames, arranging them in some sort of order. It seemed to her that if she could arrange them right, they had the power to tell her story, maybe parts that she herself didn't know. Now the photos fill every square inch of space in the hall leading to her room. She gives them lives and appetites, sex and dreams. She calls it her ghost wall, her orphans' collected souls, penned and saved, each opening to her like a window or a door, an unknown world waiting on the other side. There's not a single one without some semblance of goodness, some form of redemption.
Jill McCorkle's new novel is entitled Carolina Moon. Set in fictional North Carolina, close to both river and ocean, the book combines murder mystery, love story, and a critique of the self-help movement. It comes to us in the voices of memorable small-town characters. Among them are Tom Lowe, a young man in search of his father, Denny, a young woman fleeing a bad marriage, and Queen Mary Stutz Purdy, nicknamed Quee, a puppeteer and magician, white witch and benevolent busybody. With another excerpt from Carolina Moon, here again is Jill McCorkle.
If you're listening to these tapes, then there's a very good chance that I'm dead. So fine, listen, sit back and enjoy yourself. My name is Mary Denise Parks, but everybody calls me Denny, just like the restaurant. I'm 35 years old and on my way to Fulton, North Carolina, where I have a job waiting for me. I'm going to put my crazy magnet properties to good use and become a therapist. I've never been a therapist. I only took introduction to psych in college, where I majored in recreation. Serious recreation, of course. People were crazy about me in Virginia, where I lived as the wife of an academic, an English professor who spent his whole life researching writers who had allergies. He referred to them as the Asthmatics, which I said sounded like a punk rock band that might be into leather and little face masks like Dennis Hopper used in Blue Velvet. People said my husband must be such an interesting person. Yeah, right. That's why I felt inclined to take off all my clothes while watching Body Heat in a public theater. William Hurt was so close I could have spit a raisinette and hit him. I was almost shed of everything when the manager of the theater came and asked me to put my clothes back on, and then somebody called my husband to come and get me. He was so mad, his jaw clenched tightly. I faked several sneezes to distract him and went on about my business. I knew I was out of there.
Jill, welcome back to Soundings. It's such a pleasure to see you.
Great to be here.
Congratulations on Carolina Moon. My goodness, you have a lot going on in this book, a murder mystery and a love story, and you're saying some things about the self-help movement and the therapist. Let's talk about Quee, and let's talk about Denny. Tell us quickly about them.
Okay. Well, the novel originally started with the voice of Denny, who is a self-proclaimed therapist. My original idea was quite simple. It was Pandora's box, and I had this self-proclaimed therapist coming into a small town and wooing and winning the trust of everyone, only to some unlikely moment self-combust and spew the dirt back into the town and leave. And that was Denny, but... She never moved beyond that, and it was a much funnier idea than what the novel ultimately became. And I think with the creation of the character Quee, though mm-hmm. she certainly is an eccentric character, I found a very different tone and heart for the book. I think Quee is the ultimate matchmaker of sorts, not necessarily matching couples, but really trying to help fill the empty spots in
lives. You call her a puppeteer and a magician. She has godlike qualities. She's sort of like a white witch, isn't she?
She is. I must confess, people keep saying to me, do you know Quee? And I'm like, I wish. You know, for me, right. Quee was just my dream character.
Mm-hmm.
Because though people may question some of her actions and thoughts, I see her at core as total benevolence.
She's a good person. Now, she has, my goodness, this is complicated. She writes a series of letters to somebody called the Wayward One, who turns out to be the father of another character in Carolina Moon. Is it possible to give us a quick sketch of what's going on there?
Sure. 25 years before the present structure begins, a local man in the town committed suicide, and all that he left to his estranged son is a piece of property that prior to Hurricane Hazel was a great piece of property and since 1954 has been submerged.
Right.
And so basically this kid was left with underwater property and the legacy of a suicide. And he goes out every day at low tide to claim his land. And he's really, you know, searching for a place. And Quee does step in
uh-huh.
to assist him.
You want to tell us about the relationship between Quee and Cecil, about the man who kills himself? What's going on there?
I think what all of the characters have in common is that there is an unresolved relationship. And you don't know in the beginning who's writing the letters to Wayward One, though
uh-huh.
I think it wasn't important to me that it remain a mystery. What was important to me is that it showed two very different voices of the same person, the outer and the inner. And she has just never been able to resolve this death or to understand it. And yet at the same time, much of her life is propelled by this kind of longing, this ghost mm-hmm. of the past.
Not to mention her desire to help other people.
Right.
She helps the young women of Fulton. She sort of conspires with one of the local physicians and gets in trouble with the doctor's husband for that.
Mm-hmm.
How about it?
I'm concerned about how much plot to give away.
Right.
But yeah, she's a smart woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's truly an entrepreneur. You meet her, and it's what you see is the goofier side, you know, a woman who has created
this flamboyant
ceramic
woman,
meats,
right.
you know,
yeah.
for example, for the vegetarian. So
mm-hmm.
you have this lovely ceramic crown pork roast in the center of your table, but no meat prepared or eaten. So she's always inventing things, and her most recent business is the smokeout clinic with
mm-hmm.
the idea that smokers should be loved and pampered out of their addiction.
Now, what are you doing with the self-help movement here? Are you making fun of people who are trying to kick the habit, or are you bringing them along?
I'm not making fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think oftentimes I had a lot of fun with various techniques a therapist might use. Like at one point, Denny comes up with, she has people, you know, describe a setting, and then she calls it the flora and the fauna of the mental landscape. You know,
right.
do you like the tightly pruned privet hedge, or do you like rambling roses, you know, thorny and fragrant? So she gets a lot of mileage out of it. I had fun doing all of that. But the truth is, when I quit smoking 9 years ago, I remember thinking that I would rather be in labor and have a baby
than fight
every
that.
Day
uh-huh.
than to have to quit smoking.
So
again.
You poured a lot of that energy into
I
this
I did.
Book.
It was the hardest thing I've ever done. Mm-hmm. And I remember at the time thinking if I had money to blow, I would love to open a place where people could just be massaged and put in cool dark rooms to watch movies.
And get over the habit.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't smoke in movies. You don't smoke in church. I opted for movies. That's how I spent my time.
Fair enough. Jill, your book is Carolina Moon. There's also a murder mystery at work here. Let me read to you from your own book. When people are missing in Marsh County, the river is one of the first places to go. Tell us about Jones Jameson.
Oh,
is this a villain? Is that a word to use here?
Jones Jameson is, he's just an awful guy. You know,
I'm really sorry that you made him a radio type after
all. Well, no, we'll talk about that. He's not a humanities DJ.
Whatever that is.
That title is reserved for a select few. but he's just an awful guy. You know, Qui, in talking about her ghost wall and these photos, she says only occasionally is there a face that she can't bring home and live with. And that's how I always feel about my characters. I'm always seeking redemption. And once I have found it, it doesn't mean I love this person, but if I have some sense of understanding uh-huh. of how this person works and what led him here, then I'm able to handle it. I could not redeem Jones Jameson. It's like I had no choice but to kill him. And I did.
Jill, your book is Carolina Moon. Among your memorable characters is Queen Mary Stutz Purdy. Her nickname is Qui. How did you invent this character?
I had Qui in place. The letters came much later. And what happened with the letters, I've always been fascinated by the process of writing letters, because for years I had what I call letter phobia, which is you'd mail it and then you'd like want to get a string and bubble gum and get it back out of the box. I finally learned about 20 years ago that you should always save the letter, read it the next morning before you stamp it and mail it.
So I take it you don't fool around a lot with email, huh? Yeah, I mean, when
I don't do email.
When that's gone,
Yeah. I don't. I would be a nervous wreck with email. I couldn't retrieve anything. But I also noticed that when you write a letter you really want to send, you've said everything you really want to, that somehow as soon as you drop it in the slot, it's like weights are lifted, mm-hmm. you know, and I never sort of think about the jumbled letters in the back room of the post office, the truck, the plane.
Well, that's how your book opens.
Just
you've got this guy at the
it.
Post office. Right. Who's, he's the man who's enjoying these letters, so
right.
to speak, and telling us what's
right.
going on.
But for her, I think it's just the process of writing.
Right.
And that's also, I think, my commentary on writing. I mean, there's so much in the process. And I realized while I was working on this book, my dad died. And we were very, very close. And I would find myself oftentimes talking to him in my head. You mm-hmm. know, it's like all these things I wanted to tell him about. And it was almost like writing a letter. And I would feel so good after I had like driven the turnpike to work and had felt like I had communicated just by constructing what's like a letter. And then I thought, that's what's missing. This secret communication that we all have with loved ones, living and dead.
Well,
we continue to communicate.
You write about ghosts in this book, and there they are.
And that was the missing piece of the novel. When I went back and did the letters, it was like, it was just the heavy...
falling into place.
The heavy thread to pull it all together.
Jill McCorkle is the author of 6 books of fiction. Her latest novel is entitled Carolina Moon, available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, more new fiction. Writer Marley Yeomans is here now to read from and talk about her new book, Catherwood, the story of a young woman and her infant daughter who find themselves lost in the American wilderness in the year 1676.
Torque-like, fear encircled her throat with its dull, constant pressure. On their seventh day in the forest, Catherwood could no longer believe that Gabriel would find them, or that she would discover herself on the doorstep of home. For 6 days she had wandered in circles, trying to cross the path. Once she had dreamed someone fired a fowling piece in the woods, but she had waked to nothing but the whistles of birds. Elizabeth's fingers fluttered on her eyelids. "Ma," she said, "way up." When Kath opened her eyes, there was Elizabeth and the big wilderness of America.
Marley Yeomans is the author of Catherwood. The novel is set in the year 1676 and narrated from the perspective of a young woman who comes to the New World as the bride of a young aristocrat. But Catherwood's adventure in the American Eden is utterly transformed when she finds herself and her infant daughter lost in the wilderness near Albany. One reviewer calls Marley Yeoman's writing trenchant, graceful, sumptuously archaic, filled with a richness that provides more than just period color. With another excerpt from her novel Catherwood, here again is Marley Yeoman's.
Unwearied, the clouds let down storm after storm of snow in January and early February. One night Kath got up, leaving Gabriel's warm curve in the shelter of bed curtains and valance, the big counterpane of yellow camlet that had belonged to her mother. She stepped around Fan, asleep in the trundle bed. Her belly felt tight, her skin a hot sheath. She waded out in a dry, hissing snow to the trapper's tree where the men hung animals for safekeeping before they were skinned. A fisher, a kind of great weasel, black as ebony, with pearly teeth and a few white wisps among the long and faintly crinkled fur, twirled slowly from a hempen rope beside a bobcat, its stippled markings crisp in the starlight, the bludgeon mark on its nose a single purple berry. "Dear Christ, this world shows very lovely, fierce," Kath whispered. Discreet stars of snow slanted past, now and again catching and holding to the fisher's midnight fur. Kath closed her eyes. Indians and unicorns fled through the night forest, each as fabulous as the other. Far to the south slumbered Virginia's malarial kingdom of small farmers and artisans, indentured servants and slaves. They slept dreamless and weary while planters and their children stepped in intricate dances, sacred and profane, under the graceful spinning wheel of the zodiac, under the roof tree of heaven. East, where the sleepless dissenters transcribe the world of wonders into their pained, vacillating diaries, mermaids and spirited sea beasts jostle together under Massachusetts Bay. Outside in the threatening Indian dark lay the black and sooty sockets of last year's towns, torched by Metacomet. Liquid heat trickled down her leg. Then the water spurted from her womb, pulsing and throbbing forth until it seemed that all the world's seas broke from a single bag of water, until the snow melted under her feet. Catherwood opened her eyes. Gabriel stood watching her from the open door, a candle shining in his hand. The fisher and cat spun almost imperceptibly under bare trees, under a blazing mantle of stars.
Now, I will leave it to you, Marley, to give our listeners a sense of what actually unfolds in this novel. Again, we have Catherwood and her little girl, Elizabeth, who just utterly by accident wander away and find themselves lost in the wilderness. Can you give us a concrete sense of what happens to them there?
I think of Catherwood as a book made of a series of interlocking journeys so that she makes her way to the New World. She settles. Then she has a child. She becomes lost with the child. And in the wilderness, she finds many physical dangers to herself and to her child, Elizabeth. And then when she finally finds some human beings, she finds herself in Westfield, right. Massachusetts, with the Puritans. And there I've thought of that as a shift from her, the physical danger, to a sort of soul danger, spiritual danger.
Give us a sense of this beautiful but dangerous world that Catherwood inhabits and finds herself wandering in.
I've always been interested in early documents that show the North American wilderness is sort of dripping with grapes, you know, full of immense trees.
The Eden image.
Right,
yeah.
And interested in early descriptions of things like passenger pigeons blackening mm-hmm. the sky. I've been very interested in the sort of intensity and abundance of the world. And, of course, people at that time would have felt that the world was far more threatening, even back home in England. Mm-hmm. Certainly Catherwood would have found that the dark and the outdoors was more of a danger to her than we find today mm-hmm. when we have put malls and sidewalks over the world.
Let's talk about this very deep relationship, this bond between a mother and a daughter. I won't accuse you of having written a psychological thriller, but in a way, Catherwood might be described that way, in the sense that we have a lot of explicit action. We have a very palpable sense of the world that they're wandering in. And yet, at another level, this book is about the spiritual and the emotional bonds between a parent and a child. Talk to us about that.
Well, I think that probably comes directly from my own experience as a mother. That's probably the one thing in the book that does relate to my life, that I did have a small daughter and a small son when I wrote the book. I wrote it in Cooperstown, and I wrote it on a landing in my stairs where it was a very stormy year that year, and there always seemed to be snow blowing against the window pane. Mm-hmm. It was always that nice blue twilight color. Mm-hmm. And I often think that year was a little bit similar to Catherwood's year, full of weather. I was making my own little journey in writing the book and watching my children.
Do you want to give us a sense, Marley, of whether Catherwood is a book about gaining or about losing?
That's interesting. I think that right from the beginning, I wanted to create a character in Catherwood who would be able to go through some of the most terrible things that a woman can go through, and who would, despite that, come through changed, but with still a kind of vigor mm-hmm. for life. Mm. That would not abandon her.
Is this book about motherhood now or motherhood on the American frontier, what, almost 325 years ago?
Well, I think any book that's set in historical time, any fiction is both of today and of that time, because when I make a book, I certainly feel that I create another world. It's not the same world. Mm-hmm. It's not the world of today. It's not the world of the 17th century. It's a sort of separate reality with its own laws and limits. Uh-huh. When I think about Catherwood, what I want my readers to see is a kind of wholeness. I don't want them to single out some meaning. I want them to see and to have an entire experience. You know, I try to make prose that's freighted with feeling, mm-hmm. that is composed of words in the very rightest order that I can give, and that has a powerful story to tell.
Is it an exaggeration, Marley, to say that this book is also about the larger lineaments of American culture? Again, we have a mother and a daughter lost in the wilderness, but it also is emblematic, I suppose would be the word, of what goes on in our society when we speak of parents and children and being lost or being found, having an identity fitting in. Now, am I exaggerating the symbolism of the book? How do you respond?
The other day, a reader said something I thought very interesting about the particular issue of how American the book is, something I had not thought about. She wondered if Catherwood had not crossed in her journey, crossed from being a person from another country to being a true American in a way that would take the other characters in the book, you know, maybe several generations. I thought that was a very interesting idea and interesting way of looking at it.
Marley Yeomans is the author of Catherwood, a novel available from Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 859. Our email address is sounding, S-O-U-N-D-I-N-G, at ga.unc.edu. Visit our site on the internet at www.nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week, children's literature and the heroic couplet. Join me for conversations with literary scholars Ulrich Knoffelmacher of Princeton University and J. Paul Hunter of the University of Chicago. Ulrich Knoffelmacher will be here to discuss children's literature as a form of dialogue between past and present selves. Paul Hunter will also be on hand to talk about the heroic couplet, its rhyme and its reason. Finally, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided 1-888-650-TOUR. That's 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.